You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
I'm Anna Sale, in for Leonard Lopate. There's no denying that Shakespeare is the quintessential British writer, but since the Revolutionary War, we in the former colonies have claimed him as our own. His influence in America over the generations has been profound, essential, and ubiquitous. When de Tocqueville visited America in the 1830s, he was moved to say there was hardly a hut in this country without a volume or two of Shakespeare inside. Author and scholar James Shapiro's latest book, Shakespeare in America, is a collection of writings about the bard by Americans. It's published by the Library of America, and I'm so glad it brings James Shapiro here to the Leonard Lopate Show on the eve of Shakespeare's 450th birthday.
Welcome, great to James. Be here with you.
So this collection brings together American writings on Shakespeare throughout U.S. history. The first is from 1776, a time of complicated feelings in America about the British. How did revolutionaries feel about Shakespeare?
You would think that Shakespeare was big in America in the late 18th century, not as big as one would imagine. But the most famous plays like Hamlet, were common currency. If you wanted to make a political argument, you could just quote the to be or not to be and run it any way you wanted. So there were actually two or three versions of that speech politicized over economic and other political differences at that time. So you can just see Shakespeare as a wedge author from the beginning of our country's history.
A wedge author, you say. One of the most remarkable stories in the book takes place in Corpus Christi in January 1846. Tell me about that Shakespeare
that
production.
That may be the strangest Shakespeare story I've ever come across and may ever come across. It's the eve of the war with Mexico. Over half the U.S. Army has been sent down to Texas to provoke a war, which everyone knows is about increasing the number of slave states, and everyone knows will probably precipitate civil war. And among the men who were there were some of the great leaders who a decade or so later would fight against each other in that civil war. The men had nothing to do but fight and drink. So the officers decided, let's build a theater and put on theatricals, because this was a time where everybody really knew Shakespeare. They decided, for reasons that are really complicated, even to Shakespeare scholars, to put on that most racially charged play, Othello. And they were doing it with an all-male cast.
They pick Othello.
They pick Othello, and the first guy they choose to play Desdemona is Longstreet, hero of the South during the during the Civil War, and terrific general. He's too tall. He's about 6 feet tall. He's just too tall to play Desdemona. So they find a guy who's 5'7", 135 pounds, about your size, but he has a 2 or 3 inch beard to play Desdemona. And his name is Ulysses S. Grant. And he rehearses the part. After the war, Longstreet, looking back and talking about this, said, Grant looked great in a dress, but he couldn't generate enough sentiment for Theodoric Porter, who's playing Othello, to play against him. But the idea of a U.S. president seeing the issues of race and militarism through the eyes of Desdemona, to me, is just remarkable.
Take us to that time. How did they think about Othello? What did they think Othello was about in 1846?
Othello is one of the major strands of my book, because I think more than any other play written by Shakespeare, it has spoken to Americans in ways that it hasn't spoken to the English, to the Irish, to the French or German, to everybody else who has an equal share in Shakespeare. In the 19th century, in the mid-19th century, it meant not necessarily the same things it meant to us. For a group of soldiers, this was also not only a play about race, but this was also a play about men going off to war. And in the Cyprus scenes, men who drink too much and do dumb things while they are drinking and fighting. So I think that would have appealed to them. 100 years later, when an African-American was first able to play the role of Othello on Broadway, it marked another chapter in the story of Othello in America. And towards the end of my collection, there's a wonderful poem about the miseries of suburban life and the suburban commute called God. It's a riff on Othello, and it's called A Common Grind. I think I'm doing B.J. Ward a disservice. The Daily Grind, a wonderful poem that speaks to what happens when a guy wakes up every morning and instead of reading the New York Times over breakfast, reads the last act of Othello. And it makes him suspicious of his wife, his neighbors, the people he carpools with. So I think Othello is a work that each generation of American writers have approached in a fresh way. And that speaks to us as Americans very powerfully.
You say that Othello was routinely performed in the South before the Civil War. You have a story about Ira Aldridge, born a slave in Kentucky, who went to London and was the first black man to play Othello. When did that happen?
Ira Aldridge grew up in New York City. He couldn't play Othello in New York. And there's a wonderful play going on at St. Anne's in Brooklyn right now about his story. And it's a very poignant story. He could not play Othello in the States because a black man could not play the role. Over 100 years would have to pass before what was permitted in London would be permitted on the Broadway stage. And the story of Othello is a very, very fraught one in terms of Americans' theatrical history. I should say that it was amazingly a very popular play before the Civil War in the South, and I've never been able to wrap my head around that. And one of the most amazing essays that I didn't know about before I started putting this collection together was an essay written by a Southern woman who was a profound sympathizer with the Confederacy. Her name is Mary Preston. And she wrote a poignant and sad essay on Othello, which ends, "Othello was a white man." You can feel the last gasp of the Confederacy in this essay that she published in 1869.
I'm speaking with James Shapiro, a professor of English at Columbia University and an editor of the new collection, Shakespeare in America. On the other side, you include an essay by John Quincy Adams, an abolitionist, about Othello. His reading on Othello is quite interesting.
It's heartbreaking, really. Those who know about Adams know he was at the forefront of the fight against slavery, fought the Amistad case in front of the courts, stood up and fought against the Mexican War, was really the champion of anti-slavery movement. And yet, when he writes about Othello, he writes about how horrified and disgusted he is that Desdemona would run away with a black man and let a black man have sex with her, basically. So it's one thing. And what I really love about this piece is it speaks to the habit of Americans to say one thing in the public realm and another in their writing. And things leak out when people write about Shakespeare that are troubling, that offer us, if you will, an alternative version of U.S. history. Not so black and white, more jagged and troubling, but all the more powerful.
John Quincy Adams, abolitionist, opposed to interracial marriage, and we see that in his analysis
yes.
of Othello. You also include other writings by U.S. presidents. I love the letter that Abraham Lincoln writes where he references Shakespeare. What does he say?
Lincoln probably read Shakespeare as deeply as anyone, and his readings in Shakespeare are unusual. When he was having his portrait taken, out of boredom, I suppose, he recited speeches he had committed to memory. He didn't recite To Be or Not to Be. He recited Claudius's guilt-ridden speech. He recites a speech from Richard III. He always carried around Shakespeare with him, and many presidents do. Truman and Eisenhower were exposed to and wrote about in high school The Merchant of Venice. Bill Clinton wrote a beautiful and eloquent foreword to my book because he was one of those presidents who engaged Shakespeare deeply. I think that these are individuals who deal with intense pressure, unbearable pressure all the time, presidents. And they turn to Shakespeare because Shakespeare puts his characters under unbearable pressure.
And they have a lot to say about power.
They have a lot to say about ambition and power and intrigue. And sadly, the man who assassinated Lincoln was a great Shakespeare actor who defended his assassination on the grounds that, like Brutus, he was deposing a tyrant. So it cuts both ways. Shakespeare has played both good and bad roles in American history.
You write about the passions Americans have had for Shakespeare. Let's talk about the Astor Place riots. What happened there?
Not very far away from where we're sitting. There were bloody riots. I think one thing American history has that British history doesn't is we have killed each other over Shakespeare in 1849 at Astor Place. A British star performer, MacReady, was playing Macbeth. And a bunch of rowdy guys, thousands of them, lined up outside the theater. They were supporters of Forrest, an American actor playing Macbeth across town. And they rioted. And the guard was called out and militia. And they fired at the crowd. They killed 20. They wounded over 100. And it really marked a turning point, I think, in a certain way. The temperature had really gone up. And the ways in which Shakespeare belonged to everyone were starting to diminish. And I think we have the high-low split that we've had for much of the 20th century, highbrow, lowbrow Shakespeare.
Interesting. So post-Civil War, how does our interpretation and the Shakespeare plays and poems that we look to, how does that change?
One of the things that happens is universities start teaching Shakespeare. So Shakespeare becomes a little bit more elevated than it had been, and perhaps not everybody's cultural legacy. I don't think until Joe Papp started Shakespeare in the Park and the movement to make everybody on stage look like everybody in the audience did you really have until the Second World War, post-Second World War, a shift back to what you had in the 19th century. I think Shakespeare right now belongs to everybody. Everybody certainly studies Romeo and Juliet and other top plays in high school or junior high. And I think the hundreds of summer stock and performances across the land testify to how much we've embraced him.
Bringing to the Great Depression and the Works Progress Administration, and a young Orson Welles puts together a production of Macbeth. Tell us about that.
Voodoo Macbeth in Harlem. An extraordinary production. I suppose I'm often asked what productions of Shakespeare would I most like to have seen. Sure, some are in 1599, but some are in 20th century America. I would have loved to have seen Robeson's Othello. I would have loved to have seen Voodoo Macbeth by Orson Welles, or Orson Welles's no less brilliant Julius Caesar about fascism in the pre-war period. I think Americans have been able to appropriate and transform Shakespeare, not just on stage in formal plays, but in the musical, in West Side Story and The Boys from Syracuse. We've figured out how to meld Shakespeare to our popular forms.
And one of the ways you write about, you know, we think of Shakespeare adaptations and we think of West Side Story, but you write about its influence throughout American literature. How did Melville feel about Shakespeare?
Melville wanted to be the American Shakespeare, and he writes a lovely piece about Hawthorne, which is really about Melville and how much he wants to be the American Shakespeare. We talk about the great American novel, but I think beyond the aspirations to be the great American novelist is to be the rival of Shakespeare. And some American writers have pushed Shakespeare away and others have pulled him closer. Melville read Shakespeare very closely. But it turns out that every American writer read Shakespeare closely. And one of the things that was thrilling for me was to find writer after writer, who I admired for other genres, turn out to be brilliant on the subject of Shakespeare. Funny writers, Woody Allen, James Thurber. I mean, there are really extraordinary voices in this collection.
And what does Woody Allen say about Shakespeare in this collection?
Woody Allen has this just wicked piece about people who want to believe that somebody else wrote Shakespeare. And if Woody Allen's good at anything, it's good at debunking. And he has just a lightness and a wit that professors do not have.
There's a piece also in the collection, Nathaniel Hawthorne, writing about that controversy, about whether Shakespeare really wrote Shakespeare.
Yeah, recollections recollections of a gifted woman about Delia Bacon, who's one of the heroines of this collection, a really brilliant, damaged woman who thought that she could go to Stratford, dig up Shakespeare's grave, find the lost manuscripts, and rewrite the story of Shakespeare and of American history at the same time. And she becomes the mad woman in the attic for Hawthorne. So many currents in American literature flow through an engagement with Shakespeare.
And you see American history flow through these interpretations of history. One of the poems that I love in the collection is Adrienne Rich's After Dark, which she writes in 1966. Tell us about that.
You would think that for Adrienne Rich, a dead white male is the last kind of author she would want to invoke. And yet, in trying to struggle with her own tortured relationship with a very difficult father, it's King Lear and the language of Shakespeare that gives her a kind of local habitation and a name, as Shakespeare might have put it, to identify her anger, her independence, her disappointment. It's a terrific poem. And poets in particular, Frost is a great one. Contemporary ones like Jan Bevan is great at it too, have been able to find in Shakespeare a way of Jen Bevan, I should say, who writes, or rather creates out of Shakespeare's sonnets, a brilliant way of making us see our own world differently. She takes one of Shakespeare's sonnets and puts in bold certain key words in that sonnet. And in the wake of the tragedy, really, of the World Trade Center, she takes, I guess it's sonnet number 64, and discovers in that sonnet the words, "I've seen towers downraised, loss and loss." And even coming downtown here, I always look up to see the Twin Towers. And I think of what she's done with that sonnet that I can never read the same way again, that fixes that moment so powerfully.
Hmm. Mary McCarthy wrote an interesting piece that sees parallels between Macbeth and the Cold War world. What does she describe?
She is wicked. She is just wicked. I wish I could write like Mary. I wish I could write like many. But what I love about her essay is, and about Jane Addams, the two real discoveries for me. Mary McCarthy is able to look at Macbeth and throw out the window all the stuff that's being taught about this great tragic hero in classrooms across the land. She sees in him a Scottish golfer. She sees in him an embodiment of banality. And even as her friend Hannah Arendt is writing about Eichmann and banality, she's taking, and they're corresponding about this, she's taking the story of Macbeth and saying, at this Cold War moment, who has their finger on the button that could unleash nuclear destruction? Men like Macbeth. And it's just brilliant, and she's just a terrific reader of Shakespeare.
So you have consulted on many Shakespeare productions, both in the United States and in England. What have you observed about the differences in the ways, what Americans look for when they're performing Shakespeare and what British performers look
for? That's a great, great question. I get to work with the Royal Shakespeare Company. I get to work with the Public Theater, and I think they embody those models. The Americans gravitate towards something that speaks, I think, with great immediacy to the audience at that time. I'm working on King Lear. John Lithgow is going to be doing that this summer in the park, and it's going to be terrific. And Dan Sullivan, in production after production, is able just to speak to what's in our hearts as New Yorkers and Americans, whatever it is. He did it with Al Pacino in The Merchant of Venice. He does it time and again. The RSC are almost like the New York Times. They're the productions of record. They've just come out. Tony Scher is doing a brilliant, brilliant Henry IV Part 1 and 2. And in a way, they're for all time if the versions that we're seeing in New York are for now. I think different companies speak to their own nations in ways that they have to. I'm an Anglophile, and I used to collapse the difference between America and England and think it's Shakespeare's the same everywhere. And in a way, my book is an act of penance for ever having believed that. They're radically different, and I'm only beginning to understand how important Shakespeare is to America.
We've talked about Othello. We've talked about Macbeth. The Tempest shows up again and again in these writings. What are some of the American views on The Tempest?
The Tempest is such a politically charged play. It's part of the mini canon in America that you see again and again. It's about colonialism. It's about the Americas. It's the closest Shakespeare ever came to these shores, if you will. I think if you look at the history of Calibans and Prosperos on the American stage over the last 150 years, you can track the changing ways of thinking about world domination, colonialism, master-slave, servant-master relationships, and also the familial, the father-daughter, the Prospero Miranda story. And Shakespeare always gives us the political and the familial. And I think at politically charged times, we gravitate towards the history plays and the political plays. And at other moments, and it's useful to understand there is this alternation, we turn inward more, look at in productions of, there must be six productions of Lear passing through New York this year. Some focus on the political, most focus, like the wonderful one at Theater for New Audience right now, on the personalities of the family dynamic at the heart of the story. So I think Shakespeare is a kind of a canary in the coal mine telling us about our culture at various moments in ways that we're all only vaguely aware of.
How aware was Shakespeare of the New World and of America?
Shakespeare was aware of the New World, but unlike a lot of people, he wasn't speculating and investing in anything but land in his hometown. I think he was listening to conversations of people coming back from those worlds. I think he was watching when the ships sailed in 1606 to form the Jamestown colony. So he was aware, but his interest was always on his audience at the Globe and Blackfriars theaters. I think we necessarily have to look outward from our own theaters, speaking to our own audiences.
Let's talk about P.T. Barnum and William Shakespeare. We've talked a lot about the literary threads of Shakespeare's writing, but Americans also saw him as sort of a business venture and got excited about celebrating Shakespeare.
You want to always own a piece of Shakespeare. When Jefferson and Adams went over to visit Stratford in the late 18th century, Adams, his wife tells us, took a little relic of a chair back with him. They must have been selling hundreds of these relics in Stratford. Everybody wants a piece of Shakespeare. Barnum thought big. When he discovered that Shakespeare's house in Stratford-upon-Avon was run down and for sale, he decided to bid on it, dismantle it, and bring it back. Hue and cry in England, we have to save this cultural legacy. It's a good thing for Stratford-upon-Avon. It wasn't removed because you want a piece of him all the time. And I think it's a great story about entrepreneurship, Shakespeare's businessman, and the American desire, if we can't go there, we're going to bring him here.
And right in line with that, have you seen the recent headlines about the two antique book collectors who claim to have purchased Shakespeare's reference book on eBay?
It's another great relic story, too late to have been included in my book. They spent the last few years, The New Yorker has a great piece on it this week, trying to prove that this book they discovered has been annotated by Shakespeare himself. It's annotated by a contemporary of Shakespeare. I haven't looked into it fully enough to know that they are absolutely wrong, but I've looked far enough into it to know that they are likely to be wrong. But it tells you again how overpowering the desire is to be connected to the physical Shakespeare.
I've been speaking with Shakespeare scholar James Shapiro about how the poet and playwright influenced America's literary heritage and American politics. His anthology is called Shakespeare in America. It's published by the Library of America. And James Shapiro will be speaking on Thursday night at 8:15 at the 92nd Street Y. For more information, visit our show page. James, thanks so much for coming in.
That was a lot of fun speaking with you. Thank you.